Okay, this is David Lowell, tape 14.
Okay. We had decided on the spur of the moment to move our directors' meeting from Toronto to, we're meeting in one of the law offices in Toronto, to our little company office in Vancouver. And we checked airline schedules and rushed to our hotels and grabbed our suitcases and checked out of the hotels and all. It's a fairly long trip to Vancouver, and we flew to Vancouver and got started again with the meeting in our office. And in the meantime, we were getting under the counter communiques from the Placer Dome office. Placer Dome had called a spur-of-the-moment meeting of directors that week because of this Purina deal. And so, one of their directors had come all the way from Australia, and some had come from the United States, and they were having their meeting, and we got under-the-counter reports from somebody in Placer's office about who had arrived and what the rumor was that they were doing. David Jackson said, I predict that Barrick will show up here tomorrow. And I thought, well, this is taking a lot for granted to think that'll happen. We started our meeting early in the morning. We were really kind of frantic. Didn't know what was going to be the best thing to do. I got a phone call at about 7 o'clock in the morning, and it was a kind of a slightly garbled voice on the call, it said, hello, David, this is Bob Smith, and I said, hello, Bob, where are you? He said, well, I'm on our corporate jet, and we're going to arrive in Vancouver in 45 minutes. they had left in the middle of the night and had flown to Vancouver. So then we had another meeting, and
Placer had not come up with a counter offer.
They were agonizing about that.
We had not heard from them.
But we had not heard from them, and Bob Smith. We had a meeting then it was in the hotel where they checked in. And the meeting was just between Bob Smith and Catherine and myself. And we talked for a couple hours, and he offered to raise the offer to $30 from $27, and Catherine and I had a little huddle, and I said, okay, the $30 translated into $1 billion Canadian, or a little over $1 billion, Bob Smith, when we shook hands and left, said, Catherine, thanks a million. And she said, no, Bob, thanks a billion. that was kind of the end of the Arequipa story, I had...
You decided then to, you recommended it to your stockholders up there?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And they signed up just about 100%. I have later done some consulting work for Barrick, and have had two trips to Purina and the Barrick jet to sort of progress visits. Purina.
Excuse me, did this force you out then as a stockholder too?
Yes, yes.
There was no...
Yes, and
they
I
didn't allow you to continue in there?
No.
I see. Mm-hmm.
No, I was some kind of a director for mm-hmm. a couple of months, but I was forced out, and have participated a little bit, but in a very minor way in planning and of their work in Peru. Mm-hmm. And I think they've done a very good job. Mine is going to go into production. First gold will be poured in November or December of this year, which is some kind of a record for speed in a deposit of this sort. The production cost of the gold will be maybe the lowest of any large mine in the world. It's going to cost less than $50 an ounce to produce gold. The total reserves are about 8 million ounces. Barrick calculated that their price would result in a break-even operation at 3.5 million ounces, so it's turned out to be very profitable for them.
And none of your stockholders came back to you for...
No.
With a complaint.
No, nobody complained.
All happy.
And everybody lived happily ever after.
So. Win-win situation.
So,
and it was, this of course is why you received the award, or one of the reasons that you received the award from the, at the university.
Yes, in Peru.
I would assume
yes.
That,
you know, yes, that's
because
right.
Because of the importance of that to Peru.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So
that must have been pretty exciting.
Oh, it was very exciting that week, and that was one of the worst weeks of my life.
I'm sure.
In the continuous directors' meeting, and
had Barrick been one of the companies that you would have liked to have seen?
Yes.
Take it over.
Yes.
They obviously had visited the property. Had you discussed with your directors or with Catherine which company you would like eventually to sell to?
No, we hadn't. We hadn't.
You hadn't targeted anybody?
No. Well, we were negotiating with several companies, and each company had a different sort of a offer, mm-hmm. and this was the only cash on the barrelhead buyout that we had considered. I had years before given part of my Aquario stock to my three children, and I had a lawyer advise on how this should be done. So,
your participation was through Aquarius?
It was originally through Aquarius, mm-hmm. and then through Arequipa, but mm-hmm. By their getting the stock early, it was very advantageous tax-wise, and they had to pay capital gains tax on the proceeds, but otherwise we would have had to pay twice as much tax on.
Why does a company, well, I guess it doesn't matter. It's kind of irrelevant to try to think why Barrick did what they did, but would it, I assume it might have been easier for you if some, if they had just offered to merge or to buy the company instead of going through this hostile takeover.
Yes, I think from our point of view, it turned out very well. It was great good luck at the. This was at a euphoric period in Canadian mining. There were three companies that were getting lots of publicity at that time: Purina and Voisey Bay, which was a base metal deposit in Newfoundland, and Briex, which later turned out to be a scam. Mm-hmm. This is a little side note in the story, but after the sale was consummated, Barrick was one of the companies that was trying to make a deal with Briex on this imaginary huge gold deposit in Indonesia. And Barrick asked us to write a letter to David Walsh, who was the president of Briex, telling Mr. Walsh what a pleasant experience it had been dealing with Barrick, to try to help Barrick in making a deal. And we passed a draft of a letter back and forth by fax, and the last draft that I sent back to Catherine, it was typed out, and I wrote in pencil down at the bottom, P.S., Mr. Walsh, is Briex a scam? And this was a joke between Catherine and myself, and it was before the scandal broke on Briex, but I had been suspicious from the sound of it that it might be a phony project, and I turned out to be exactly right. But it wasn't of any particular interest to me. I had never considered buying stock, or I was never involved in.
But had this offer not come from Barrick, you still would have been trying to sell your.
Yes. That's right.
Or make some sort of merger or deal.
Yes, and I would probably have opted to make a deal with somebody like Placer Dome or Newmont. And
allow them to do the operation?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We would probably have received stock in one of the major companies from somebody else, or a good part of the payment would have been in the form of stock, which also, in retrospect, would have turned out to be unlucky for us, because all of the mining companies' stocks have gone down since.
This way it was over and done with.
Yes.
Right then, but you had to take the chance.
I actually we had an option to receive part of the payment in Barrick stock, and Barrick asked me to do that. They didn't demand that I do it, but they said it would be helpful to them if my particular ownership was in the form of cash plus Barrick shares, because it would help the
cash flow
image-wise. Oh. would be a vote of confidence in Barrick, and I did that. But I soon afterwards sold the Barrick shares, which also turned out to be a lucky break because the gold stocks have gone way down. Barrick is worth only half now what it was then. What do you say we break
okay.
for lunch?
All right, we're continuing after a little lunch break here, and you had a few further thoughts about Barrick.
Well, just a little postscript to the Arequipa story. Because of our finder's fee arrangement, the Arequipa Perina discovery and the sale to Barrick resulted in quite a number of millionaires in our group, and I think the total is something like seven or more people that worked in Arequipa ended the story with a windfall profit, and one of them was Katie McLeod, the president of Arequipa in the last stage, and she is a gal now about 36 or 37 years old.
Oh, a young woman.
And she ended up with a big house on a golf course in Vancouver and a very nice husband and a Labrador Retriever pup, and she has become director of a number of different Canadian companies. There was an article in London Financial Post, I believe, with the title Golden Girl.
Did she have the husband before she got so rich?
No, he came along with the rest of it.
It helped in that too.
And so that's all I have to say about the adventure in Peru. My
you got an awfully nice windfall from it too.
Well, I did, and it actually didn't really change my standard of living or affect my life too much, but it's, some aspects of it have been fun and some kind of worrisome, but it was an exciting experience. I'm at the present time kind of gone back to my habit of doing independent exploration projects, and a good part of my work now is in joint venture or strategic alliance type of joint projects with Rio Tinto, English company, which is the largest mining company in the world, I guess. They own Kennecott Copper and U.S. Borax and U.S. and various companies in other parts of the world. They're now a part owner in the Escondida deposit. They have a 35% interest in that. And
is this how you made your contact with them?
No. My contact with them came through people that I know in who are with Kennecott Copper or were with Kennecott Copper. And the principal, one of this group, is Tom Patton, who was vice president in charge of exploration for Kennecott and later Rio Tinto's manager in South America. And the I have two projects underway in which Rio Tinto is contributing part of the financing. One is mostly in Arizona and Sonora, Mexico, looking for porphyry copper deposits, and the other one is in northern Chile in South America, also looking for porphyry copper deposits. And most of the people working for me in both places are longtime former employees. Ernesto Eggert and Maria Elena Aspiaga in Chile have probably worked a total of 12 years for me in the past. And these are projects that are sort of low budget, low profile, low technology budgets of the sort that I've always done. And we're optimistic that we'll find an ore body somewhere, which might turn out to be a sort of a swan song for me. But
what sort of arrangement do you make with Rio Tinto for this?
Well, the projects are 75% owned by Rio Tinto and 25% owned by me. And during the first 2 years, they're supplying most of the finance, but I'm contributing part of it. And the if deposits are found, they would, if they meet their minimum size standards, which are huge, they would put the deposits in production, and I would be a small minority partner. If they don't meet the standards, the discoveries, hypothetical discoveries, will belong to me, and I would be free to do something else with them. And other things that have been happening in my life since the Purina discovery is I've received a honorary degree at Universidad de San Marcos in Peru. And
you did talk some about that yesterday. There might be more you want to add.
Well, no, I think I would just mention it again. And and I've also been nominated for a couple of other things that haven't been confirmed as yet. One is become a member of the National Academy of Engineering, and another one is Mining Metallurgical Society of America Gold Medal, but these are not yet confirmed. I might talk a bit about my family and general philosophy of life and so forth.
Before you do that, just One little thing that, when I was having lunch just now with Marcia, she told me that in the winter, you and Edith and Marcia are accustomed to taking a walk after lunch to relieve your stress. And I thought you might want to mention how that came about. And I think it's a very intelligent way to cope with stress.
Well, it came about probably more by accident than by shrewd planning, but I have had a exercise program pretty continuously for maybe the last 30 or 40 years, and the main reason in my case is that my work is erratic. I may work in the office for 2 weeks continuously, and then the following day be asked to climb a 14,000 foot high mountain. And it's a survival technique to try to stay in at least minimally good physical condition. Marcia is also a exercise person, and I think it was she that got us started taking a walk at lunch hour. We have an exercise machine in the office and another one in our house for getting a little exercise now and then.
So you didn't just jump on the fitness bandwagon recently then?
No.
No.
No, I've been going at it for a long time.
That's wonderful. Well, let's hear some more about your family. You've mentioned their births, and that's really all that you've said about them.
Well, as I mentioned before, I was married at an early age, 20 years old, when I was about to finish my third year of college.
You had a quite elaborate wedding, I gather, from the picture.
Well, it was a big church wedding. My theory is that big weddings are designed to preserve the marriage because the husband involved can't face the thought of having a second one.
Where were you married?
In Tucson.
In what church?
It was an Episcopal church. I believe the name of it, it's now gone, but I think it was called St. Andrew's Episcopal Church. I've been an Episcopalian all my life, but I'm not much of a churchgoer. I average once or twice a year, probably. My wife was studying anthropology in the University of Arizona. She has a degree in anthropology with a minor in geology and Spanish. And she later returned to college. At the time, I struck out into the consulting business to get a teaching credential, and then a master's degree in Spanish. And she worked a couple of years as a elementary school teacher. She taught in the fifth grade. She also taught Spanish courses in elementary school. And she obviously speaks good Spanish, and this was a help in when we lived in Mexico and in Chile. And she had an opportunity in Chile to write an archaeological article which was published in the United States about tabletas de rapé, which are stone or wooden tablets that were, or trays that were used in hallucinogenic drug ingestion in ancient times in South America. And
what was that word? Rapé?
Rapé.
How's it spelled?
I believe it's something like R-A-P-A-E, but not sure of that.
Anyway, okay.
And our oldest daughter was born when we were both very young, and as a result we have a granddaughter that is of college age this year, and another one.
Let's get their names. We have Susan's name already, but what are the daughter's names?
The daughter who is entering Princeton, or is now in Princeton, is Anna. Mm-hmm. And Anna's is a very impressive gal and was a national merit finalist in the basis of her grade average. I might just hop back to Susie, who was born October 27, 1950, in Chihuahua City, Mexico. Susie's always been a very serious child, and she was kind of precocious and learned to talk and walk and read a little bit ahead of schedule. And she's, through her childhood, she was very much of a older sister with her brothers. She's been a very good student. She was valedictorian in her high school, and national merit scholar, and presidential scholar. And she's always been a little bit on the shy side, but had a summer job as a
newspaper reporter.
For 2 years, and she got a BA degree in English from Stanford and an MA from Stanford in creative writing, and married Ross Humphreys, who was also a summer newspaper photographer at the same time she was with the newspaper. Susie went ahead to get a PhD from Princeton University in English Literature, and taught English creative writing at the University of Texas and then the University of Arizona. And she has published, I'm not sure of the number, but I think 7 or 8 books, most of which are children's books, and they've been well received. She's won a total of 5 literary prizes, and one of her children's books has been published in more than 700,000 copies.
Which one is that?
That was a Three Little Javelinas.
Uh-huh.
And she has 2 daughters, the oldest Anna, who is in Princeton, and younger Mary is in junior high school. Her husband is a graduate of Wharton School of Finance, was a McKinsey management consultant, and now owns and operates a publishing company in Tucson. Our second son, Bill, was born April 18, 1952 in Tucson. And Bill has had a variety of dyslexia, which interfered a lot with his life. He did reasonably well through high school, but struck out a couple of times in college. And he learned to be a welder and diesel mechanic, and worked at that for a long time, and he most recently, as a result of shares of stock that he had in Arequipa, has returned to Tucson and is now attending some liberal arts classes in the University of Arizona. He has a pilot's license and a helicopter license and does a lot of flying. Our youngest son, Doug, was born June 6, 1956 in Prescott, Arizona. Doug is another one that has been very precocious in terms of learning to walk and talk early, and he's a kind of a fast thinker, fast talker, always doing unexpected things, and we had to take him to the emergency ward 4 times by age 12, including once when he rode a motorcycle over a cliff.
Before he was 12?
Before he was 12.
Oh.
He was invited by a motorcycle dealer to participate in motocross racing for dealership. And he's also the child that I've had the closest relationship of the three. Although there are quite a few people that thought it might be a good idea to kill him between age 6 and 20. Mm-hmm. And, but he was a National Merit finalist from high school, and when he graduated from the University of Arizona, he was admitted to Harvard Medical School, and he got an MD in general surgery at Chase Presbyterian, Chicago, and a cardiovascular certificate at University of Indiana. Spent a year doing pediatric heart surgery at Brompton Hospital in London. He's now practicing in Tucson, and has been a success, was a Tucson Physician of the Year, currently has the best open heart survival statistics in Southern Arizona. Mm-hmm. He's married to daughter of a friend of ours in Nogales. He lives in Tucson, and they have 3 daughters and a son ranging in age from 3 months to 10 years.
Let's have, what is his wife's name?
Doug's wife's name is Roxanne Chernin.
Oh, it's here. You've got it here. Okay. And
the kids' names are Marcella, Glenton, Michelle, and Paloma.
Well, now, wait a minute. You've got Marcella, but I don't have the others.
The second one is Glenton.
G-L-E-N. T-O-N. Is this a boy or a girl?
Boy. The third is Michelle.
How many L's?
Don't know.
Okay. And that's a girl.
A girl. And the last, who is only a couple months old, is Paloma.
Paloma, a little girl, I presume.
Yes.
Okay.
And they're all charming kids.
Oh, I'm sure. Marcella is the oldest. Marcella is the oldest. I see. And Anna and Mary are Susan's. Okay. Well, lovely family.
And you mentioned chatting a little bit about philosophy and so on. I have always been interested in science, but not much interested in pure science, and very interested in applied science. And my modus operandi is to try to think of ways that scientific advances can be applied to practical mineral exploration, and I've had some success at that, but I've also had several worked on several blind alleys, things that didn't work out. I've had a very pragmatic attitude, cost-benefit regarding how to do exploration. I started off, as I mentioned, as a mining engineer, and worked at that for a couple of years, and then part-time as a mine manager later. And I've always felt that it was a big advantage to understand something about the production side of mining while looking for new mines. Mining is essentially based on economic principles and not scientific principles, and ore is rock that can be mined at a profit. And I think this has been a big advantage to me, and I've talked to other people with similar backgrounds who have the same feeling. I've tried to be honest and ethical in my work. I've never been arrested or charged with a crime or sued in the course of my career. And I have tried to operate on the basis of do unto others as you wish them to do unto you. And has a kind of particular application in mineral exploration, because it's very much a dog-eat-dog business. And my feeling is that a person should try hard and fight hard, but remember the rules while you're fighting. And can't think of anything else to add to that. Do you have some questions?
Well, that's a wonderful summation, and you've surely proved that you can be successful at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few more little detailed questions that I had. You didn't mention anything about going to China.
Well,
Shoemaker had spoken of the trip that you took to China, and maybe you took others, I don't know.
I've made two trips to China, and I'm currently called a special advisor for a company called Zen, which is trying to develop mines in China.
That doesn't sound very pragmatic.
And I'm fond of most of the Chinese people that I have met in China, but...
What was the occasion for your trips?
Well, the first trip was a people-to-people sort of junket trip, I was talked into going because a couple of friends, were going and asked me to go. One was Charles Meyer, who was at Berkeley.
He was on our first advice, on the original advisory committee for this oral history series.
Well, that's interesting. Another was Harold Courtright.
Died too soon, unfortunately.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Charlie Myers was one of the handful of best porphyry copper geologists, I believe, and also said to be a very good teacher. And
so you went to China with Chuck and Virginia?
Yes.
I see. And the Courtrights, you said.
And I gave a number of talks in China on that trip, we had Chinese interpreter whose name was Mrs. Chin, who was a young lady who had been a very bright, well-educated gal, and she had been assigned the job of shoveling coal into a furnace during the Cultural Revolution, and almost died as a result. And Edith got sick during our trip, got something like pneumonia in our first trip to China. And she had to be dropped off at a hospital, they left Mrs. Chin with us to help out. She was in the hospital for 2 days, I think. And first and last, we got very well acquainted with Mrs. Chin, and she's written letters to us a number of times, and we get pictures of her little boy and Christmas cards and so on. The second trip was for DuPont, I participated in that one, I think, as a result of Bob Shoemaker's suggestion. Bob Shoemaker is a very well-known metallurgist who was president of the American Institute of Mining Engineers at one time. Bob and I worked together for Bechtel on feasibility studies and have since had other projects in common. And Bob was one of a couple of people that went over as metallurgical specialists, and I wrote a paper called Geology and Mining of Gold for the symposium. And we had talks for two or three days in Qingdao, and then went out and visited gold mines and plants and so forth. And we were in, one of the DuPont people with me was a young fellow named Tom Quo, and Tom was a super impressive American of Chinese ancestry, and had a degree from Caltech and a degree from MIT, and a very charming fellow. And he was a grandson of one of Chiang Kai-shek's generals in the Civil War in China. And he took us, took Edith and myself over to see Chiang Kai-shek's summer home, which was at Chindao. And he still had relatives in China and relatives in Taiwan, and he was able to give us a very interesting insight into the evolution of the Chinese political situation and the relationship of offshore Chinese to people living in China.
Well, when were these trips?
Well, I don't remember. The first trip was probably about 1980, and the second trip about 1990.
Okay.
I've also worked elsewhere around the Orient. I made a couple of trips to Thailand and did a little work in Taiwan, and worked in Fiji Island, and Australia, and I've been to Papua New Guinea a number of times, and spent a few days at Bougainville during the construction phase of the Bougainville Copper Company.
Would you like to say anything more about any of those things?
Well, I worked twice at Octeti before construction started at Octeti. It's in the central, in the Star Mountains, central part of the island of New Guinea. And at that time was extremely isolated location. It's on the Fly River, a huge river. Or it's, that's not exactly true. It's near the Fly River. And they were doing water monitoring of streams as a preliminary to building the plant when I was there. It's a real jungle area. The year I was there, the rainfall was over 500 inches, and it was the highest rainfall of any weather station in the world at that time. And traveling around was difficult, and we moved around mostly in helicopters. And I became acquainted with the hydrologist who was checking weirs and creeks and so on, rain gauges. And I had inquired if it would be possible to see any of the natives while I was there. And the hydrologist invited me to go with him on a helicopter trip one day to visit the only native village in, that was near Octeti. Papua New Guinea was not by any means densely populated. The jungle is a very unproductive place for human habitation. And there were only small villages widely scattered in that part of New Guinea. And the one we went to was called Migilsimbip. And they had had their first view of white people something like 8 years before. And they were still probably practicing cannibals, and fairly unclothed as far as clothing goes, not totally naked, but largely so. And we visited what we took along an interpreter who was from that village, and who spoke Pidgin English as well as local language. And he showed us something that was called the Boy's House, and it's a place where boys are put to live when they're something like 6 or 7 years old, and they stay there until they become men and they're taught to be warriors and do all the things that they're supposed to do. And another house was the only building that was painted. There were probably a total of 15 buildings in this village. And I asked the interpreter what that was, and he said, that's where we keep the bones of the people and the pigs. And the pigs were a food source, but they're also considered sort of part of the population. And we saw some women that had one elongated breast, and the interpreter said that that was caused by suckling pigs.
Oh my goodness.
So they were pretty primitive stuff. In the boys' house there were some little packages tied up in leather on the wall, and spears and axes and stuff, and bows and arrows. And I asked the interpreter what these little, obviously sacred packages were, and he said, well, they're parts of the enemies.
Oh, my.
So
that was quite an experience. But they weren't any threat to you.
No. No, in my various trips to, the only sort of threatening natives that I ever saw were on Bougainville Island, which is politically part of New Guinea, but it's really a different culture. And they looked like pretty mean customers and sort of glowered and whatnot. I was with a Bechtel engineer, and there was a fellow going down the street with a umbrella in one hand and a bow and arrow on the other hand. I said, stop, I would like to take a picture of him. And I thought it was a kind of a humorous picture. And he said, oh, I wouldn't advise you to do that. He said, I tried to take a picture of a fellow with a bow and arrow once, and when I got the camera focused, he had the arrow notched and was pointing it at me. And later, this same group rebelled against the authorities and took over the mine, and CRA has never gotten the mine back.
No.
My principal hobby has been skin diving, and in some of my commuting back and forth across the Pacific, I arranged to stop at Truk Lagoon, and I was by myself, but I was able to hire a truckies fellow, and who got us some tanks, and we dove for a couple of days on sunken Japanese ships, and one of the interesting things he knew about was in the hull of a Japanese transport, and we had a light and went back through holes and passageways, and there was a Japanese Zero airplane stacked in with gasoline barrels, and I was able to climb with my tanks into the seat of the Zero, 90 feet below the surface of the water.
Well, it's quite an adventure.
The Japanese had come back after the war and put up a shrine in that ship, and part of the Shunto, religion.
Paul Gondineau.
Well, he was just a one of many people involved with various projects that I've had. Paul Gondineau was a French fellow living in Santiago, Chile, and he was Utah International's agent for selling coal in southern South America. And when we started our project, Utah happily offered Paul to help in arrangements, and it turned out to be help that I've been much better off without. In geology, people have divided geologists into lumpers and splitters, and splitters are the people that subdivide things into smaller and smaller categories, and the lumpers are people that lump things together and generalize, and I'm the worst kind of a lumper, and Paul Gondineau is the worst kind of a splitter, and he loved regulations and red tape, and I brought in three heavy-duty four-wheel drive Chevy pickups from the United States, and they were supposed to be sent with a package of spare parts, all the parts that were likely to need replacing for the first couple of years, and the packages didn't arrive with the pickups, and I had to get them ordered afterwards, and there were something like 500 different parts, and the regulations at that time allowed lumping things together up to groups of $500 for import purposes. But Paul Gondineau made out a separate import application, which was several pages long, for each part, and we ended up with hundreds of pages of applications, and which made the created delays in getting through the customs officials. And that was kind of typical of the Paul Gondineau syndrome, and I tried to cut corners on getting things done, and Paul had accountants and lawyers in Santiago, and he would pounce on each one of these infractions, trying to get it all done exactly properly, but it was.